another morning here in Music City, USA, getting you set for another day of sports talk here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Coming up at 10, it will be Darren, Donick, and Chase live from Bridgestone Arena for another day of Predators training camp as they'll be hitting the ice at noon. And speaking of the Preds, that's where we will start with today's rundown. As Captain Roman Josi yesterday was named finalist for the Norris Trophy. Huge surprise there yesterday that Roman Josi was named finalist for the Norris Trophy, using my sarcasm right there, because Roman Josi should win the Norris Trophy when the winners are announced during the NHL's conference finals in September here in about 6 to 8 weeks. The other finalists, along with Roman Josi, were Washington's John Carlson and Tampa Bay's Victor Hedman, and really the debate has been Josi or Carlson for the Norris Trophy, and it would be an outrage for a lot of people in Nashville if Josi lost to another Carlson in the Norris Trophy race, as Shea Weber years ago in 2012 lost to Eric Carlson with the Ottawa Senators at the time, when Shea Weber was deserving of winning the Norris Trophy at that time, but Eric Carlson, in the closest Norris Trophy voting ever, ended up winning the Norris that season. And Roman Josi yesterday, after he was named a finalist by the National Hockey League and the Pro Hockey Writers Association, joined a press conference to discuss being named finalist, and he talked about what it would mean to him to be the first ever Preds defenseman to win the Norris Trophy.
Yeah, it would definitely mean a lot. I mean, obviously there's been some great defensemen coming to Nashville, and Shea, who was nominated a couple of times and definitely deserves to win an award when he was nominated. But I think it would mean a lot. I mean, it's a huge honor to be nominated, and yeah, winning a Norris Trophy would definitely be a dream come true.
That's Roman Josi yesterday on being nominated as a finalist for the Norris Trophy, saying it would be a dream come true. He said that as well back earlier in quarantine when he was going through some media availabilities. It's the first time in Josi's career that he's been nominated for the Norris Trophy. Again, John Carlson, Victor Hedman, the other finalists for the Norris Trophy. The winners will be announced during the NHL's conference finals coming up in September. Speaking of the NHL, yesterday they came out with a statement from their PR Twitter account saying that they have conducted over 2,600 COVID-19 tests in the time frame of July 13th through the 17th, and only two of those 2,618 tests ended up being positive. Total of 800 players were tested during that time frame from the 13th through the 17th, so that would have been last Monday through Friday, and only two positive tests over that time. Marquise Munson behind the glass, you know, there were a lot of worries for sports, especially when the Nashville SC stuff happened a couple weeks ago, where they got kicked out of the MLS's back tournament once they got that down there to Orlando because they had a 9 positive tests within their traveling camp, but only two out of over 2,600 tests by the NHL. Now, this week is going to be the real test, if you want to call it that, for the National Hockey League, because who knows over the course of 2 weeks whether or not someone contracted COVID-19 and then they end up having a positive test within those 14 days. So I kind of feel like if they can get through this week and get to Edmonton without having a big outbreak within the league, that the NHL's plan is going to go pretty smoothly as they try to get qualifying rounds started up August 1.
Yeah, and that's always the biggest concern with all the sports, is just getting to the bubble. And once you get to the bubble, I think everything is fine, because we've even seen with the NBA, which when MLS happened, it made me nervous, because guess what? MLS is playing in the same campus as the NBA. And the NBA also did their, you know, they conducted tests yesterday, and zero NBA players tested positive out of 346 tests. And this is on July 13th when those last results were announced. So you know, that's big and that's huge. And that means that everything that they're doing, all the protocols that they're doing within the bubble is working because no player within the bubble is testing positive.
Now,
and we're seeing players like hanging out, going fishing together and everything. And yet no player has tested positive. So that means, you know, the NBA and the NHL both need a round of applause because guess what? They're doing this right. I know NHL is a little different because they have phases that they're going through before everybody gets to the bubble. And it's worked perfect, and it's good because we all want sports, and they're making it, they're doing it the right way.
Yeah, and this is the biggest difference between, say, the National Hockey League, MLS, and NBA, is that they are staying within a bubble to conduct their comeback within their respective leagues. But the thing that helps those leagues is that they're essentially doing this in a postseason setting. Like, when the regular season... when the next regular season starts for NHL and NBA, and if there's still a lot of COVID-19 cases out there in this country, are they still going to be playing in a bubble in Edmonton or in Toronto? I don't think so. I don't think you could pull off a regular season in one or two hub cities. And to relate that to NFL and MLB, they're trying to come back with a regular season. So they are not in a bubble. That's where they have the obstacles themselves of once the players leave either training camp or in the NFL or the ballpark in MLB, they're on their own to stay healthy and follow all the right protocols. It's not like they're staying within a campus of their own. I mean, they're going back home. Who knows what they're doing outside of the ballpark, outside of the training complex, but you know, between practices or between games. So
yeah,
that's where the NFL and MLB, if they can get through this successfully as well, then I think that's a really good sign for sports moving forward.
Yeah, but at least they have the blueprint for it. And they know, and I know the NFL and the NFLPA have been having their issues about safety protocol and how to handle this whole situation. They can look at NHL and they can look at the NBA and say that, hey, you know, how did you guys do it? You know, how are you guys making sure you're keeping all your players from testing negative and, you know, being able to move forward with your season? Yeah, I know you're in a bubble, and obviously we have to worry about that portion of it on our own. But as far as the testing and keeping the players healthy, and how did you go about doing that? And I think if they take that protocol of, you know, if MLB and NA and the NFL does what basketball and hockey are doing, then we can get all four core sports back and going without any kind of, you know, players testing positive, players having to pull out, because that was the biggest concern is if this all starts, what if a player within that bubble or within that season tested positive? Like, what is a team going to do? And, you know, so far, so good for the NBA and NHL. So hopefully baseball and football holds that same protocol.
Right. But all it takes is just one or two players to screw it up for everybody else. Because let's say for Major League Baseball or for NFL, one or two players on a single team, you know, overstep their boundaries and go out for, you know, a dinner with a friend at a restaurant. And they follow all the right safety measures, but because they did that, they contract COVID-19. They bring it into the locker rooms, and then there's an outbreak within that team. Then all the red flags are going to go up around that entire sport that there's been an outbreak within just one team. So this is going to take a whole lot of precaution from every single player within the National Football League and Major League Baseball to successfully pull this off.
Yeah, because that's what happened pretty much initially with the NBA is, you know, Rudy Gobert tested positive.
Yeah.
That's just one player. You know, Rudy Gobert tested positive, and then it was pretty much a ripple effect from there where everybody had to get tested and everybody, the whole season
sports
got shut down.
For
sports shut down. Then Donovan Mitchell tested positive. Then they had to test like the Raptors and the team they played before and everything. And then it was just a ripple effect of
remember
things.
John Forslund, the Carolina Hurricanes play-by-play announcer, was in the same hotel room as Rudy Gobert. They retraced steps, and John Forslund then quarantined for 14 days because Rudy Gobert used the same hotel room for a couple days that Forslund was using. But also, that was a time where everything was just so fresh and unknown with COVID-19. We were not comfortable. If someone tested positive, there was just this great unknown of what was going to happen from there, where there's, you know, you don't, you may not feel more comfortable with someone testing positive.
You have a better understanding.
But you have a much better understanding of how you can go about getting around it than we did back in March when everything just completely shut down.
Yeah, absolutely. When we're just going business as usual, and then once sports shut down, that's when everything got taken seriously. And you know, it's, and hopefully, like I said, the NFL and baseball are just paying attention to what other sports are doing. It's the reason why, you know, we try to get all these commissioners together and working together within this, because if we want all sports back, we're going to all have to, you know, look at what each other is doing in order to get plans on how to move forward with our season. So, you know, as long as they follow that protocol, because Adam Silver and Gary Bettman, they pretty much know what they're doing when it comes to how to handle this. So kudos to them.
For sure. And Marquise, yesterday we discussed a lot the NFL and the fact that the players came out over the weekend with the hashtag We Want to Play and voiced their concerns about not having enough info on the NFL's plan to come back with training camp starting on time next week. And the NFL and the NFLPA yesterday came to an agreement on some of the testing protocols, that for the first 2 weeks of training camp, they will be tested daily for COVID-19, and it will go to every other day beyond those first 2 weeks if the positive test rate is below 5%. So the NFL and NFLPA moving forward to an agreement to start training camps next week, and according to ESPN's Adam Schefter, the NFL is now considering having zero preseason games after the NFL was looking at or had come out and said that they were going to reduce it from 4 to 2. The players want zero. Now the NFL is considering zero preseason games, which is probably the best way to go about it. I mean,
I thought players just needed one game just to get going and just to get, you know, and obviously now we're going to have to take into account that we're probably going to see some sloppy football in week 1, 2, and maybe 3. And then maybe it'll start picking up later.
At least the
first 2 weeks of the season, it's going to be some pretty sloppy play because, you know, guys aren't really in there. There's a difference between like game shape and like practice shape. And it's like that's where we're going to get some sloppy football, but hey, we'll get football, and that's the main thing. And you know, preseason to me was, I never really paid attention to preseason other than, you know, just to watch some of the rookies play,
right?
And other than that, then I really can care less about preseason, and I'm pretty sure NFL players feel the same way. So,
but the sloppiness is something that we're going to have to get used to with NHL. I mean, they're going to have 2.5 weeks of camp or practices, one exhibition game, and then it's the postseason. I don't know if we can sit here and honestly say that on August 1, it's going to look like playoff hockey. Because not only are the players not going to be fully up to speed and in midseason form, but they also have to get used to, A, a hub city, and B, no fans in the stands. And that is going to be awkward for a lot of players to try to have that playoff intensity without having that crowd that can fuel a lot of that energy and
now,
emotion.
Yeah, and now for rookies, this is like really a strong test for rookies. Like, look at a guy like Joe Burrow, who is a potential starting quarterback for his team, and now he's got to go into this situation to where he has no preseason. He doesn't have 4 games to kind of get this in-game gel with his team. Like, he's going to really have to hone in on training camp, and obviously he's going to report to rookie camp as well. So he's really going to have to hone in on that stuff, and that's for every rookie that has to compete.
I'm glad you brought that up, because I think that helps the Titans, and we'll get to that coming up next here on The Rundown. Plus, the Toronto Blue Jays are looking for a stadium to play in. We'll address that as well coming up next. He's Marquise Munson. I'm Ryan Porth. You're listening to The Rundown on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Welcome back into The Rundown. Ryan Porth, Marquise Munson here with you on this Tuesday morning. Darren Donick and Chase coming up live from Bridgestone Arena at the top of the hour as the Preds have another day of on-ice practicing starting at noon as they get set to head to the hub city of Edmonton this weekend to prepare for the NHL's return to play next week. So, Marquise, last segment you mentioned how Joe Burrow, rookie quarterback, what is that going to look like for him if there are zero preseason games? And as I said last segment, the NFL is now considering zero preseason games, according to ESPN's Adam Schefter. And not only for the case of Joe Burrow, but also let's look at a team like the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, where, yes, they're getting the GOAT in Tom Brady, but they're also getting Rob Gronkowski, and Tom Brady hasn't had a lot of time on the field, if any, with guys like Mike Evans and Chris Godwin and the rest of that Buccaneers offense. And there was a lot of movement in March across the NFL. But when you take into account the Titans offense, there's not a whole lot that's different now compared to what it was last season in the playoffs. I mean, the biggest difference on offense is the fact that they lost Jack Conklin at right tackle. But you have Dennis Kelly, who has been a Swiss Army knife for the last few years for the Titans offensive line. You would think with zero preseason games that week one against Denver on Monday night, Dennis Kelly would be starting at right tackle over rookie Isaiah Wilson, especially with zero preseason games for Isaiah Wilson to prove himself. I think that gives the Titans a pretty big advantage early in the season when you take into account they'd be facing the Denver Broncos. The Denver Broncos look good on paper. Also, Drew Locke doesn't have a ton of experience as starting quarterback for the Broncos. Melvin Gordon is new. Jerry Jeudy is new. KJ Hamler is new. I think that that
Philip Rivers with a new offense.
Philip Rivers and Indy. I think that gives the Titans a pretty sizable advantage over some other NFL teams moving forward. The fact that they know what they have. They were in sync for the last 13 games of the season, including the playoffs last year. I think that gives them a leg up over a lot of teams that had a lot of changes, at least on offense.
It does, but and also, and this is a point that Jared made, and what if Ryan Tannehill goes down? And then you got to go with Logan Woodside, who Logan Woodside hasn't got a lot of reps, and I haven't seen a lot of Logan Woodside, so... You know, and that's like kind of the curse of not having a veteran quarterback. What about the kicking situation, and how does that get resolved? And if that's resolved
right.
at all. So
there are still question marks.
There are still some worries. You know, is Christian Fulton going to be able to kind of just ease into that Logan Ryan spot and kind of fill that gap that he did?
The defensive line with no Jarrell Casey?
Yeah, but is Jeffrey Simmons, how, you know, is he now 100% and he's going to take over that defensive line? There's still a lot of questions, but I do get your point of, you know, there's
at least
not
on offense.
Yeah, at least on offense. But and this really, for the Titans, I think it's more so plugging in players that you've lost, you know, spaces in, and then also, you know, keeping the same core group intact. And with a lot of other teams, it's obviously different because, you know, Jerry Jeudy is going to be a big centerpiece of that offense under Drew Locke, who's, you know, only played a handful of games so far in his career. Phillip Rivers, who we saw what he can do with the Chargers, but has a brand new offense, you know, brand new wide receivers in T.Y. Hilton and a rookie. So, you know, you're going to have to fill that out. So, yeah, there's a lot of questions surrounding other teams and their pieces that they have to put intact. And it's harder when, you know, rookies are involved as well. But, you know, Titans have some rookies, too, that they want to, you know. What is Darrington Evans? Is you know, obviously he's going to take over that Deion Lewis role. So what is, you know, how is he going to fit in? So
sure.
there's questions, but I think the Titans' questions are more fill-in, more than just, you know, this is our, you know, Jerry Jeudy is going to be our offensive centerpiece, so we got to, you know, kind of work around him. So
right.
at least they don't have that problem.
I mean, the Ryan Tannehill question, you could bring that up for many starting quarterbacks. What if that quarterback goes down? Then
yeah.
either with a new backup or an experienced backup, yeah, a lot of teams are going to have that question.
Yeah, because even with the Packers, and they got a rookie quarterback backing him up in Jordan Love.
Exactly. But just on offense, between Ryan Tannehill, A.J. Brown, Derrick Henry, even Corey Davis and Adam Humphries, Jonnu Smith, you've got four of the five starting offensive linemen back. Dennis Kelly, he knows the system. So at least on offense, yes, the backup quarterback, the backup running back, there are some questions there. But if they remain healthy and COVID-free, then I like where the Titans' offense could start this season. Now, defense, a lot more question marks than there are on offense. But that comment about Joe Burrow just hit me like a ton of bricks of, okay, well, Joe Burrow will have never played a game in the NFL before he
he's
like,
going
not even a preseason.
He's going
game.
Straight from national championship game against Clemson all the way to his first week one of the NFL season. And,
right.
And that's like a hard gap. And, you know, that's with all the rookie quarterbacks, too, because let's look at a guy like Tua, who has not played since that Mississippi State game, obviously due to that injury, and he's got to go in. But lucky for him, he has like a Ryan Fitzpatrick and a Josh Rosen who can probably fill that gap, even though I'm pretty sure they wanted him to start, you know, week one or two. It's probably going to end up being Ryan Fitzpatrick in the first week because Tua's not ready yet, and he hasn't played since Mississippi State, which is back in November of last year. So, you know, it's going to be difficult for a lot of teams, but once again, you know, we're in a different time to where we have to make adjustments and we have to do things that we probably didn't think we were going to do, but we're going to have to make adjustments because that's just the time that we're in right now.
At Denver Monday night, I don't think that's as big of a deal without fans and with no preseason games for the Broncos offense to get ready for that game. I don't think that's as big of a deal or as big of a concern as of an opener for the Titans as it may have looked when the schedule came out back in April, or maybe it was May. And then week two, home Jacksonville. There's no reason why the Titans shouldn't start 2-0 before they take on the Minnesota Vikings in week three, which then leads me to, will they have Jadeveon Clowney for that week one game against the Denver Broncos? And there was a tweet from Ian Rappaport of NFL Network yesterday that stood out to me. Rap Sheet put out, quote, "With some rookies reporting to facilities and gearing up for camp, team doctors are expected to resume performing physical soon," source said, "as soon as planned health and safety precautions are in place. The NFL Physicians Society had halted them in March for COVID-19. And we all know the Titans and other NFL teams interested in Jadeveon Clowney have been waiting for physicals to be available to then sign or take next steps with Jadeveon Clowney. And this tweet from Rap Sheet that came out yesterday, you know, really triggered my thinking of, okay, Jadeveon Clowney watch could be over pretty soon. Is Clowney going to be in a Titans uniform by this time next week? The Titans should report July 28th if it doesn't get pushed back between now and then. If physicals are available between now and then, will Clowney be wearing a Titans uniform next week?
Yeah, because you got to think, you want to get him in before training camp, so obviously you want to get him in before the 28th. So does a deal get done before Friday?
Before Friday? I'm going to say by next Tuesday, by the time they're reporting, Jadeveon Clowney is a Tennessee Titan. And that's just going off pure gut. Maybe not by Friday, feels a little soon, but by the time the Titans are reporting for training camp, I think we're going to hear a lot about Jadeveon Clowney being a Tennessee Titan. That is a pure gut feeling, but the percentage I would give Clowney to the Titans is in the 80 to 90% range.
80 to 90? That's
80 to 90.
That's pretty high, man. That's a little...
I'm sold that it's going to happen. I'm sold. Personally, it's just my opinion, I am sold. The Titans players have been recruiting him on social media. The Titans went out and signed his best friend in Jonathan Joseph, who played with Clowney at South Carolina and the Houston Texans. Robinson and Vrabel have not downplayed those rumors when repeatedly asked about Clowney for months now. John Robinson even said last week on NFL Live that he may or may not have had conversations with Clowney in his camp last week. And the Titans have a need. They have salary cap space to get this done.
I think Titans are leading the way, but I'll go a little 40% maybe to the Eagles as well. The Eagles are kind of a quiet one for Clowney as far as this is concerned. So
I'd be curious to know Philadelphia's cap space and whether or not they could take the Titans. If they could take the Titans approach. The Titans, let's say Robinson didn't want to go over 13 or 14 million on a 1-year deal. Well, now that Derrick Henry's cap hit is only 6 million instead of 10 million for the 2020 season, J-Rob might be able to go to Clowney's camp and say, all right, how about 15? Maybe even 16. If you really want Clowney for 1 year, 15 or 16 million is very doable right now with the amount of cap space the Titans have. I think it's around 23 million that they have available to them. They also have to sign their rookies. You would think they have to bring in a quarterback, but also Robinson and Vrabel love Logan Woodside.
They do.
As reckless as that would be to go into this season without an experienced backup quarterback, they sound convinced on Logan Woodside.
Do you think?
I don't like it, but.
Do you think they'll use the extra cap space for a quarterback or a kicker? Because it's going to be one or the other.
I would use it for a quarterback.
I would use it for a quarterback, but.
I mean, kicker is important.
Steven, I mean, there's some kickers out there that are pretty good.
They cannot get by the 2020 season with the kicking situation that they had last year. I mean, they went like 2 months without attempting a field goal. I mean, it was ridiculous in November and December. They ended up in those games with either 28, 35, or 42 points, it seemed like, every single week. Because they were just scoring touchdowns every time they went down the field. They were that efficient on offense. Greg Joseph in his one season with Cleveland was not that bad.
Also, you know? Thought that about Santos too. Like when Kansas City, like he was pretty automatic for the first few years when he was in Kansas City. But then
he missed like 8 field goals against the Buffalo Bills.
And then after that, it was just like it's gone. And I don't know. That's like a weird thing with kickers. Like they for 2-3 years, they'll be just star studded, like really automatic. And then all of a sudden, they just like they fall off, like John Lambeau, and I just like kickers could just go on and on. I don't see a veteran. What is there a veteran quarterback out there that the Titans could sign? Because you already missed out on Jameis Winston. You missed out on Cam Newton, and they were both pretty cheap. And, Joe Flacco, you missed out on that. So
Jared said yes. Jared and Joe yesterday said something that I would agree with, that Case Keenum at this point would be an okay backup quarterback to have in their situation. A lot better option than Logan Woodside. I would even take Blake Bortles over Logan Woodside as your backup. As your backup who has NFL experience, Logan Woodside hasn't thrown one pass in the NFL.
I know, but nah, Blake Bortles, nah. Probably not Blake Bortles.
It's process Case of elimination Case on Keenum, Blake Bortles.
Case Keenum, yeah. I can get you on Case Keenum. Like Case Keenum for sure, yeah.
He's respectable.
He's a respectable backup. Blake Bortles? I just don't know, man. Last time I seen Blake Bortles, he was just completely awful. But, I mean, it's better than a guy who I guess hasn't thrown a pass. So, I mean, yeah, Blake Bortles is good, a better option probably than Logan Woodside. But if you can get Case Keenum, let's just go ahead and get Case Keenum.
I would take Case Keenum in a heartbeat over Logan Woodside. Coming up next, we've been talking about the NFL. What about college football? What's the latest on that front? We'll hear from Paul Feinbaum. He was on this station just a couple days ago. We will hear from Paul Feinbaum on the other side, plus some interesting comments from a Group of Five head coach that came out on The Athletic yesterday. That's all coming up next on The Rundown. He's Marquise Munson. I'm Ryan Porth. You are listening to The Rundown, ESPN 102.5 The Game.
Yeah, I mean, I think the level of concern is pretty high. I would maybe not go DEFCON 1, but somewhere around DEFCON 3, because even though I think we all know that the people that matter are committed to seeing it through, there are just so many obstacles to get through. And I hate to get into the nuances of COVID, but I think the testing issue is overwhelming. I think they'll try to get the season underway, and that's why camps are open and voluntary workouts are now about to shift into directed workouts. But it's a really tough gamble to say that they'll be able to get from this point to the next one. And I think it's evident by all these other leagues canceling or postponing to the spring. And, every day there's another one. And every time there's one that comes out, you start to go, okay, I know I've heard of that league. I don't know who's in that league. But it shows that a lot of people in pretty important positions, like commissioners and athletic directors and especially presidents of schools, around the country don't feel like they can do it. And the biggest reason is the money. We're not talking about the NHL here. We're not talking about the NBA that can drop $200 million in Orlando. We're talking about individual colleges that just don't have the funds.
That was Paul Feinbaum Friday morning with Darren Donick and Chase on his thoughts on the college football season for 2020. There's still a lot of question marks with college football, not just conference by conference, but for the sport as a whole, whether or not we're going to see college football in 2020, because all the additional obstacles that college football has in addition to what the professional sports have. But he brought up the money as a big thing for college football wanting to make this happen almost at all costs, and having the last resort be a cancellation of the 2020 season or having to shift to a spring season just to get some of that money from the TV networks. And you know, if by then there can be ticket sales, that would be great as well. But obviously the very last resort is scrapping the 2020 college football season altogether. I still have my doubts about the college football season happening. And it's a completely different animal from the National Football League, where you have an abundance of more players that you're trying to keep quarantined when they're not at practice or at a film session or at the facilities. And there are more obstacles with that on a college campus than there are within somebody's daily lives. So it's a mess. You have each conference on their own. The Big Ten has already said they're going conference only. Greg Sankey with the SEC has said that they're going to wait until later this month to decide whether or not they will go conference only or if they are going to stick with non-conference games in addition to conference only games as well. And speaking of Greg Sankey, Greg Sankey is going to be on HBO's Real Sports tonight. It's going to air at 9 o'clock Central Time. And Greg Sankey sat down with David Scott. And Greg Sankey has been very vocal here in the last, I would say, 10 days about how everyone needs to follow the health protocols correctly. And if you don't start doing it sooner rather than later, then there may not be college football this season. But HBO Real Sports put out a teaser video for this episode that's going to air tonight, and David Scott with HBO sat down with Greg Sankey for this episode of Real Sports. And Greg Sankey had some comments that were pretty interesting to a lot of people. Here is the teaser video of Greg Sankey with HBO.
To the extent that you have already flown, I gather, hundreds of athletes back to your campuses for training, haven't you already put them at an increased risk of infection?
Well, first of all, let's be clear. We haven't flown student-athletes back to our campuses. Some of our student-athletes will drive. Others will make their own arrangements. So we haven't done that. Again, you're asking a question in comparison. So in comparison to what? To having them work out in homes or home gyms that may have been their own hot spots without oversight of sports medicine specialists, without strength and conditioning coaches. And that reality informed what I still believe was the right decision.
Can I ask you, sir, to speak to your own numbers in the conference? How many of the SEC schools have seen a positive COVID test results?
Those are questions best and appropriately asked of campuses.
Surely it is the business of the SEC if conference schools are reporting positive COVID tests. Do you know the answer?
I have regular updates as we go through our regular calls.
You don't want to tell us how many of your 14 schools have had positive COVID tests so far? Seems like a fair question.
Sure, I don't dispute you have the right to ask me the question, just as I have the right to provide the answer I've offered.
That was Greg Sankey sitting down with David Scott.
That
of
interview sounds spicy. I'm
Real
watching
Sports.
It tonight.
It also sounds awkward between those two.
Yeah,
doesn't
if you watch it, it's. But yeah, I mean, yeah. Greg, what is Greg Sankey gonna? He's not gonna tell you the number of. Look, I get the point of a reporter that you got to ask that question, but he's not gonna give you the
right
answer. It's just.
So the first question that was asked, and Greg Sankey, his response, a lot of people have taken that as Greg Sankey saying that these players are going to be safer on campus than they would be at their own homes. And I have to disagree with that. I don't know how you can say that these college athletes, these student athletes, are going to be safer on a college campus than they would be at home right now. Obviously, it's case by case, but if someone who is living in Ohio or Pennsylvania or New York plays on an SEC team, how can you say that they are better off on a campus within a hot zone compared to in Ohio or Pennsylvania or New York or whatever, where the COVID cases have been reeled in really well here in the last couple months. I don't know how Greg Sankey can say that. Like, they would have to have a bubble-like atmosphere on campus for it to be safer for them to be there than they would be at home.
Yeah, and that's what Mac Brown, I guess he did a Zoom call just a few minutes ago, and that's basically what he said that he's doing with his players in North Carolina, is basically following the same guidelines as the NBA of kind of keeping his players within a bubble, making his players lift with mask on, and doing all these proper protocols that he's doing. And he also said that during that Zoom call that 3 weeks straight that he has not had a player test positive with the virus. So, you know, maybe, but I just like, yeah, you can do that now while there's no students there and while there's not anything going on in the city. Cause like, look, I'm telling you, from a kid who's from Tuscaloosa, Tuscaloosa is a dead city when there's no school, no students on campus. It's pretty dead out there. It's pretty normal small town, but when there's students there, it is packed.
It's popping.
And it's popping. And I'm pretty sure every other college campus is like that as well. So, yeah, there's no students there now, but come August, at some schools at least, there will be.
Right.
So then, obviously, the rules change after that.
So are you going to put these student-athletes in dorms, in separate dorms, to make sure that they are separate from, you know, some of the other students that aren't athletes? And then how does that look for the rest of the university, that they're going to take care of the student athletes and put them in a bubble, but the rest of the faction of the students are on their own if they're on campus?
Yeah, and see, that's what I thought about too, of like, are you going to designate one of your halls for just athletes or just student athletes and dedicate it to that, and then have the rest of the students in the surrounding dorm areas? Because Alabama got a lot of dorms. They got a lot. I didn't stay in any of them because I stayed at home, but they had a lot of dorms there. So are you going to designate one for student athletes and call that kind of your bubble? And but then then how are you going to keep them in there? Are you going to have security at nighttime, watch the door, make sure they don't go down on the strip or Broadway or wherever their campus party scene is? Like, it's difficult for players. It's going to be difficult for college players. Yeah, guess what? You know, we got to worry about the same thing with the NFL, with basketball, with baseball. But these guys don't get paid.
Mm-hmm.
So they're risking their lives for what?
And there's no players' union.
There's no players' union to
have
them.
consistent testing procedure from conference to conference for the entire, not just Power 5, but NCAA when it comes to all this. It's a complete mess. And it is a lot more fragile than it is for pro sports leagues.
Guess who your player rep is, whoever your coach is. And I've seen different quotes from different coaches, and different coaches have different sayings and different feelings about everything that's going on. Lincoln Riley feels a lot different about this than Nick Saban. Nick Saban feels a lot different about this than Mac Brown.
Or Jimbo Fisher.
So everybody has their own say-so on how they handle things. So you're basically putting your life and your health at risk from your coach, and some of these coaches really just don't care, and some of them do, and some of them are taking this very seriously.
And we can now throw Cincinnati's Luke Fickell into this mix as well, as having a stance on college football in the fall. In an interview with The Athletic, he was asked, "I know you want to play in the fall, but I have to ask, what are your thoughts on playing in spring?" Luke Fickell said, "Nope, not even talking about it. Because that means you're not talking about the fall, and I don't talk to people who are pessimistic and thinking we can't do this in the fall. So call me if something else happens, and maybe I'll talk to you about it. But no, we're playing in the fall. We have to learn and find a way to make it work. And I think we will, because it's not going away. When we play this year, the virus is still going to be there. At some point in time, you have to dance with it, go toe-to-toe with the virus some way, somehow. Now, that doesn't mean be stupid. Doesn't mean you say the hell with it and go to every bar and pool party. No, but you're going to have to realize that there is no such thing as a bubble unless you stay quarantined in your own house. The NBA might have the closest thing to a bubble, but there is still risk involved." That was Luke Fickell in an interview with The Athletic that came out yesterday.
See,
being hard-headed about playing football in the fall.
See, I get what you're trying to say, Luke.
Sure.
But here's the thing. These are student athletes. These aren't professional athletes. You can't, you know, yeah, okay, what are my obligations of playing in the NBA or NHL or NFL, MLB is to get my contract, right? What am I playing for here? Like it's point. I'm not going to say it's pointless because a lot of these guys are going to have opportunities to play elsewhere, and a lot of these guys are getting degrees and scholarships and whatnot, but risking my health for what? Like, for what? To build more buildings for this campus? To, you know, make sure our athletic departments stay intact? Like, you're risking these student-athletes' health. And you're talking to the biggest college football fan in this city, probably. I love college football, but it's just... I'm not gonna watch it unless it's safe for them, and because at the end of the day, it's got to make sense for them. I don't want to see Trey Smith go out there from Tennessee, who already has underlying health conditions, go out there on the field and risk his life for free, and have no representation at all. So like I get it, man. Like I get you want to play football, and I want to watch football, and I want you to play football. But at the end of the day, we have to make sure it's right for them first. Like don't just go in there with that mindset of just don't be dumb and don't go to bars and don't go to pools. Like, how do you know what we're doing? How do you know playing is safe? So it's just, look, if they come out with the right protocols and safety protocols, I'm fine with them playing, but they have to do that first. And it's obviously going to have to take the commissioners and the ADs to get together and come up with those things, because if they're not going to do it and the coaches get the okay to play, they're going to play. So, you know, that's what it is. But I want to make sure it's safe for them.
Absolutely. And there's a part of me that wonders if Luke Fickell's comments would be different if Cincinnati was expected to be average this year. Cincinnati's expected to have one of the best group of five teams, potentially make it to a New Year's Six Bowl, and I wonder if they were expected to be in the middle of the pack of the American, if Luke Fickell would have different comments than, we are going to play in the fall, and we have to make it work. Don't be stupid about it, but we have to make it work. I do wonder if they would be different. Coming up next, Nashville Predators getting set for another day of on-ice camp. We will get to that coming up next here on The Rundown, ESPN 102.5 The Game. Welcome back into The Rundown. Ryan Porth, Marquise Munson here with you on this Tuesday morning. Preds getting set for another day of on-ice activity at Bridgestone Arena, where Darren Donick and Chase will be broadcasting live coming up at the top of the hour. And joining us here to weigh in on the first week of practice or so for the Nashville Predators is Willie Donick, co-host of Darren Donick and Chase and the TV voice of the Nashville Predators. Willie, how are we doing this morning?
Hey, Ryan, good to talk to you. I am in a familiar position here up in Section 310 at Bridgestone Arena. I'm watching pretty much the extra guys, the guys that they have called up from Milwaukee to be a part of this summer camp. These guys are depth players, but nonetheless very important to the organization, so they're getting their workout in right now before the regulars, if you will take the ice a little bit later. So looking forward to a big show today.
Yeah, and not many more days of practice within the city of Nashville before the Preds head up to Edmonton. I know you've attended a handful of these practices. What has stood out to you when you've been there at the arena?
Well, I've been talking a lot to Hal Gill about, you know, the focus of this. I mean, we don't want to make it any more complicated than it is. You're trying to get ready to play just like you would in any training camp. But, you know, the challenge is, as we've talked about a lot, is, you know, in a regular training camp in September, if you're a veteran player, for example, that knows they're going to be on the team, there's a way that you approach training camp, and it's a marathon, not a sprint. You know, that's the old saying. And if you make a mistake or you get off to a bit of a slow start in October, that's one thing. But getting off to a slow start in this series is pretty much the mark of the end of your season. So getting the guys ready to go at full tilt right off the bat is a challenge probably unlike anything anybody's ever done before. So you can't reinvent the wheel, but you have to be thinking along those lines every time you take the ice.
Yeah, and Predators head coach John Hines said Sunday after the scrimmage that he would like to have his lineup pretty much set in stone as much as possible before that exhibition game against the Dallas Stars. But it almost feels like he's pretty set on it right now when it comes to the line combinations. He hasn't been juggling the lines over this last week. The Jofa line put together as the top line. Then you've got Kyle Turris, Matt Duchesne, Mikael Granlund on the second line, Grimaldi, Bonino, and Smith on the third line, and then Yarncroak, Sissons, Watson on the fourth line, with guys like Colin Blackwell and Jakob Trenin being the main extras at forward. And the defensive pairs have been pretty set as well. So it does feel like John Hines, the lineup that he put out there in the first couple of days of practice, he's trying to see if that is going to be the lineup that works.
Oh, I think that's pretty clear based on what they've done. They haven't changed up much. I think the significant thing, as everybody has notated that's been following the practices, is that they have put Johansson, Forsberg, Arvidsson back together. And that line really hasn't played much together all year long. But we know what they can do when they're all at their best. I think it's the right move. And the key to all of that working not only is for those three to play at their best, but also for Kyle Turris to take that wing spot on the second line. That's something that Peter Laviolette, going back to the original training camp this year, was unwilling to do long term. He tried it, didn't like it, and scrapped it very early in the process. And they really spent all year long trying to figure out how to deploy the top six. And then there was all kinds of evolutions, and none of it really involved the Jofa line for one reason or another. So this is an approach that I think before the season started, a lot of people would have said this is how you're going to go. But it never materialized during the season. So that's going to be a very important thing to watch, because I do think it gives the Predators a chance to have, I think, their highest ceiling if they get that number one line going and everybody else falls into place.
And it will be interesting to see, you know, hypothetically, if in game one against Arizona, if those lines aren't clicking, if John Hines would stick to it for game two, or if he would juggle them at that point. Like you said earlier, the margin for error when you're starting out of the gates with a best of five in a playoff setting is slim to none. So, you know, really going with his gut on these line combinations and defensive pairs, that they are going to work out. And, you know, I know a debate that you and Darren have had is who's going to be the third D pair. You know, the fact that Dan Hamhuis was injured at the time of the pause and now he's healthy. You know, there are some people out there that would prefer Jakob Trenin over Austin Watson in the lineup, or Colin Blackwell over Austin Watson, what have you. But at the end of the day, Willie, this Preds team has proven over the last few postseasons that they're going to go as far as the top two lines take them. Because in 2018, the first line was phenomenal, but they got nothing out of the second line. They got bounced by Winnipeg. And then last year against Dallas in 2019, I mean, really the top two lines were non-existent for much of that series against the Stars. So I kind of feel like this team is going to go as far as those top six forwards take them.
Well, I think that's true over the long haul, but at the same time, you also know, Ryan, that games like this and series like these, you have those guys, the Freddie Gaudreaus, that, you know, history is fraught with those guys that you don't know very well that have a great postseason, whether it be one series, one game, you know, those guys can make the difference. Austin Watson has had big playoff games before. He's had big playoff series before. So I don't disagree at all with giving him the first crack at being in there. And I would think, you know, that fourth line especially, you know, looking at the way Colin Blackwell and Jakob Trenin played during the season, those guys, I'm sure, are itching to get in there and deserve a chance at some point. And if they do make a run, inevitably you're going to need a lot of depth. So that's why these guys that I'm watching right now are staying sharp and getting ready. Elie Tolvanen and Jonathan Davies and Ben Harper, all these guys they have dressed, but you never know who it's going to be that's going to have that big game, that big goal. And, you know, I think you can foresee a series against Arizona. If Arizona's playing the way that they want, you know, the game is going to be 2-1 or 3-2 in a lot of cases. But that's the mystery too, Ryan, of how these games are going to go. Are we going to see more of an October style of hockey where it tends to be a little looser, there's more mistakes made, and there's more goals because everybody's still molding their system? Or are we going to see more playoff style hockey where every goal is contested and you're much less likely to see that 5-4 kind of game?
Yeah, that's a great point. Willie Donick coming up here at the top of the hour alongside Darren McFarland. Darren, Donick, and Chase. Willie, thanks as always, and we look forward to hearing you guys break everything down as practice goes along today.
All right. Looking forward to it, Ryan.
All right. That was Willie Donick live from Bridgestone Arena for another day of Nashville Predators practice. For Marquise Munson, I'm Ryan Porth. You've been listening to The Rundown here on ESPN 102.5 The Game. Coming up next, it is Darren Donick and Chase.